lied. Good evening. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the thousands of viewers across the country joining in on the live stream. Thank you for being with us tonight, and thank you to Young America's Foundation, University Police, the directors of the Student Center, and all of the volunteers that helped make this event possible. My name is Evelyn Perez, and I have the honor of serving as a co-director of outreach for Young Americans for Freedom here at the University of Alabama. YAF is a premier conservative organization on campus here at Alabama and all other colleges around the country. YAF fights for free speech, limited government, free enterprise, and individual freedom, and has changed the lives of many. We have inspired students to stand up against liberal intolerance, fight for the free exchange of ideas, and promote education on conservative values. Before we begin, I'd like to cover a few house rules for tonight's lecture. We ask that you please silence your cell phones at this time to avoid distractions during our lecture. Photography is allowed, but please refrain from the use of flash. If you attempt to disrupt or protest the lecture or the Q&A, you will be escorted out by university police and you will not be refunded. Following Ben's speech, we will be holding a Q&A session, and we ask you to keep your question concise and to the point to allow space for all who want to ask questions to be able to. Form a line behind this mic when the period begins, right here. We encourage those who disagree with Ben to go to the front of the line in order to create a dialogue. With that, keep in mind fairness, integrity, respect, and inclusion are important guiding principles here at the University of Alabama. To that end, we ask that your behavior align with the principles of the UA community at all times, and we ask that you follow the spirit of our guiding principles and any direction provided by the host. If you're interested in becoming involved with conservative activism on campus and events like these, follow at UAYAF on Instagram and Twitter. I would now like to introduce the chairman of the Young Americans for Freedom chapter here at UA and member of the Young Americans for Freedom Board of Governors, Joseph Ballard.
Thank you. Thank you all very much for coming tonight, and thank you very much for that introduction, Evelyn. On behalf of the University of Alabama Young Americans for Freedom chapter, it is my honor to welcome you all to our Fred R. Allen lecture featuring Ben Shapiro. Without Young America's Foundation and patriotic Americans such as Fred Allen, events like this bringing conservative ideas to student audiences around the country would not be possible. It is now my absolute honor to introduce our keynote speaker, Ben Shapiro. Ben Shapiro was born in 1984 in Los Angeles, California. He entered the University of California at Los Angeles at the age of 16 and graduated summa cum laude in June of 2004 with a BA in political science. He then went on to graduate from Harvard Law School cum laude in June of 2007. Shapiro was hired by Creator Syndicate at age 17 to become the youngest nationally syndicated columnist in the United States. He's the author of many national bestsellers, including Brainwashed, How Universities Indoctrinate America's Youth, Project President, Bad Hair and Botox, On the Road to the White House, and many others. Shapiro has appeared on hundreds of radio and television shows around the nation, including Fox and Friends, In the Money, Scarborough Country, Fox News Live, The Glenn Beck Show, The Laura Ingraham Show, and many others. Ben currently serves as the editor-in-chief of The Daily Wire, as well as the host of The Ben Shapiro Show. Ben resides in Los Angeles, California, with his wife, Moore, who is a doctor. Together, they have one child. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming to the stage Ben Shapiro.
Great to see y'all. Thanks so much for coming. Well, first, I just want to say thank you to the University of Alabama for making it so easy to actually have an event here. We have a lot of trouble at a lot of other campuses, not here at University of Alabama, so that is wonderful. And in gratitude, I have just two words, Roll Tide. I also want to thank Young America's Foundation and Fred R. Allen for sponsoring this lecture series. Well, tonight, I'm going to be talking about abortion. You may have noticed that it's in the news lately, ever since apparently every top Democrat decided to endorse up to and including infanticide. You may have noticed there was a law passed in New York in the last couple of weeks that had legislators cheering. It had the governor of New York cheering so loudly that he actually forced all of the state sites around the state of New York to illuminate the top of the site in pink. This law suggested basically that for any reason, as long as you got one doctor to attest that it endangered the health of the mother in any way, even temporarily, abortion should be allowed up to point of birth. And of course, there was the law that was proposed in the state of Virginia, which essentially did the same. State legislator Kathy Tran in the state of Virginia, she went so far as to claim that during dilation, a baby could be aborted. And then the governor of Virginia, who it turns out is a doofus for a variety of reasons, he went on a radio show and suggested that in certain cases, if a baby was born during a botched abortion, the baby would be kept comfortable, at which point the doctor and the mother would decide what to do with the baby. He later tried to walk that back. He tried to suggest that what he was talking about was cases of terminal end-of-life care, basically, but that's not what he said. What he originally said was that in cases in which there might not be a viability problem, in cases where there is a severe abnormality but not necessarily a viability issue, even then, the baby might be kept comfortable, and then at that point, the mother and the doctor would get to decide what to do with a fully born baby. In the state of Vermont, they're going even further. They're trying to enshrine a right to abortion. This would extend all the way up through birth, all the way up to point of birth. There's only one word for this: infanticide. Unfortunately, there's an enormous swath of Americans who have been misinformed dramatically for years by the media and by the Democratic Party as to what the agenda is. Because we use euphemisms all the time when we talk about abortion. Abortion is itself a euphemism, of course. If anybody were to talk about the forcible killing of a human life, everybody would really have a better picture of what we were discussing here. But instead, we like to talk about anodyne terms like abortion or termination of pregnancy or a woman's right to choose. All of these are euphemisms. Abortion is a violent procedure by which a human life is ended, by which an incipient human life is torn apart. In late-term abortion, we're talking about fully formed children who could survive outside the womb and who can feel pain. And yet you are seeing more and more Democrats come out and endorse the view that it is perfectly okay under virtually any circumstances to kill that child. Abortion, unfortunately, has moved from being something safe, legal, and rare in the parlance of Bill Clinton in the 1990s to something celebrated, cheered, and applauded. It's celebrated by President Obama, who released a statement on the 41st anniversary of the moral abomination that is Roe v. Wade. He said, "Today, as we reflect on the 41st anniversary of the Supreme Court decision in Roe v. Wade, we recommit ourselves to the decision's guiding principle that every woman should be able to make her own choices about her body and her health. This is a country where everyone deserves the same freedom and opportunities to fulfill their dreams." Well, not quite everyone. There are the people who get killed in this process. If they're unborn, they don't deserve the freedom and opportunity to fulfill a dream. Then you can stick scissors into the back of their neck and twist it, or dismember the baby inside a woman's body and then suction them right out, because dreams are restricted to those who can speak. Here's the reality. The United States, since Roe v. Wade, has been standing on the wrong side of a great moral divide. We are participating in a great moral evil that robs hundreds of thousands of unborn of their voice, robs them of their life, and robs them of their future. So tonight I want to discuss this great evil, why it is evil, why we tolerate that evil, and how we fight that evil, because in a country where 3,000 unborn children a day are being killed, in a country where more black babies were aborted in New York City last year than born, in a country where some 55 million lives have been snuffed out since 1973 through acts of evil, in a country that watches this and declares it morally virtuous and suggests that all you're doing is enshrining a woman's right to choose, suggesting that you're standing for freedom by doing all of this, we have to return to first principles. So tonight I'm going to go through a few of the most common pro-choice arguments, and we're going to debunk them. You may have heard some of this before, you may not have. It doesn't really matter. It's important to get back to first principles, because the fact is that too many people are being put off the track of truth and reason by lies. So the first argument that you hear all the time is that babies, unborn babies, are not human. This is the most common case against the pro-life position. It was put forward by mechanical engineer and non-science observer Bill Nye, the science guy this week, who suggested that what is inside the womb is nothing. It's really nothing. It's just a fertilized egg that's nothing. Okay, let's be real about this. This is anti-scientific nonsense. The minute an egg is fertilized, it is now an independent human life. If that fertilized egg were found on Mars, we would say life found on Mars. Human life found on Mars. If we found a multicellular organism with its own DNA and blood type, there is no question that we would categorize it as a life form. At conception, a unique human being comes into being by every possible scientific measure. New life possesses human DNA and possesses its own blood type. This is an independent human life. Now, it may not be as developed as other forms of human life, but that does not mean it is not a human life. Here is a brief timeline of pregnancy. A baby's heartbeat begins at 18 days. This is very often before a woman even knows that she is pregnant. It develops its own closed circulatory system at 21 days. By week 3 after conception, the baby's brain, spinal cord, heart, and other organs begin to form. This is usually when most women find out that they are pregnant. By week 4, we are already looking at the earliest facial features. By week 7, the baby has toes. By week 9, the baby has begun the development of external genitalia. You can tell if the baby is a boy or a girl, because it turns out sex is not assigned. It is defined by biology. By week 10, the baby's fingernails have developed, and that's all in the first trimester. This is the most controversial part of pregnancy. No wonder Planned Parenthood wants to make sure that all 4D ultrasounds are shut down. They don't want people looking inside the womb. The last thing they want is people looking the ugliness of what is going on directly in the face. Now, there used to be people on the left who acknowledged this. For example, a rather famous leftist said this: abortion was the wrong way. No matter how early it was performed, it was taking life. You know who said that? That was not Pope Benedict. It was not the current pope. It was Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, who said that. When she founded Planned Parenthood, she did so because, in part, she was anti-abortion. She wanted contraception as opposed to abortion. Even the left doesn't truly believe the argument that this is not human life. If they truly believed their own point of view, then they wouldn't use euphemisms. They would be perfectly happy to talk about whatever, because the left doesn't use euphemisms when it comes to polyp removal surgeries. The left doesn't use euphemisms when it comes to just a plain stomach surgery or a surgery to remove kidney stones. If we were just talking about the removal of non-life biological material, there would be nobody who'd be afraid to talk about it. But the left is deathly afraid to talk about it, and they get very offended when you do. They get so offended when you do that if you so much as attempt to show a picture of an unborn baby, people at Twitter will try to shut it down. I recall that a couple of years ago, I tweeted out, there's a very famous photo in pro-life circles, and what should be any circles, of a 21-week-old baby who is being operated on by a surgeon in the womb. It's a very famous photo, and the baby is sticking its hand out of the mother's womb and grabbing onto the surgeon's finger. And I remember I put this photo up on Twitter, and I put up another photo that showed a miscarried baby at 21 weeks, which looks like a baby, because a 21-week-old baby is a baby. And I put this on Twitter, and they restricted it. They said it was too offensive, because we have to blind ourselves to the reality of what's going on. I recall back in 2012, I went to the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, and there were a bunch of pro-lifers, and they were out there with these giant posters of pictures of what abortion looks like. And remember, I'm from California, and this seemed unseemly to me. It just seemed gauche. Why am I looking at these really ugly photos? It's just so horrific to look at these photos. And blithely walking past are a bunch of guys who are going to the DNC, and they're wearing pins that say things like, "I love pro-choice women." I can't imagine why. And as we are walking by these posters, it occurred to me that people in 1944 would have said the same thing walking by a bunch of protesters holding up pictures from the Holocaust. Whenever human beings do things that are truly ugly, they don't want to look at the pictures of the truly ugly things that they are doing. Okay, the second argument that is commonly used by folks on the left is that these babies, these unborn children, these unborn human lives, they can't survive on their own. Viability should be the standard. But this makes no sense at all. So, contrary to the a little bit old bio that was used earlier, I have not one kid but two, and kids are not viable once they are outside the womb. They're not viable. If you just leave them alone, they will die. A newborn will die. You have to nurse the baby, you have to take care of the baby, you have to feed the baby, you have to get up in the middle of the night with the baby. My son is 2.5 years old, he's still not viable. If I leave him alone for 5 minutes, he will kill himself. He's a suicide machine. Peter Singer, an alleged ethicist at Princeton University, at least acknowledges this problem. He wrote in The Scotsman in 2009, opponents will respond that abortion is by its very nature unsafe for the fetus. They point out that abortion kills a unique living human individual. That claim is difficult to deny, at least if by human we mean a member of the species Homo sapiens. So his solution is not viability. He says that human beings, we should be able to kill them if they lack rationality, autonomy, and self-consciousness. He says killing a newborn baby is never equivalent to killing a person, that is, a being who wants to go on living. So he's with Ralph Northam on this one. If the baby is born and is lying there on the table, fully healthy, you can still kill it, because that's not the same as killing a 10-year-old. Naturally, this also means you could kill someone who is hooked up to an iron lung because there's no autonomy there. You can't live absent the iron lung. Or someone who's unconsciousness or asleep because there's no self-consciousness for that person. Or somebody who is mentally ill because there's no rationality for that person. Actually, even Singer's logic is pretty self-defeating because it assumes a binary definition of all of these terms, rationality, autonomy, and self-consciousness, because which doesn't make any sense. There's a continuum of these things, right? There's insane as in, like, legitimately certifiable, and then there's insane as you're going to vote for AOC in her next primary. The third argument you hear a lot about from people on the left is that it is responsible to abort, that the responsible thing is, I can't take care of my child. It's a real difficulty about me. It ruins my life. It makes my life much more difficult, abortion. Well, tough. I mean, so what? Lots of people make my life more difficult. I can't kill them. And I don't mean to be brutal about this, but the child is more important than whatever other needs are on your plate. And when you become a parent, you understand this. The vast majority of people in this room are too young to be parents, I hope. But, you know, I have a couple of kids, and I promise you, once you become a parent, your number one goal in life, the only thing that is important for you to do is make sure that your child is taken care of, is fed, is kept safe. That is the only thing that matters. All your other priorities go out the window. It doesn't matter what else you have on your schedule that day. That is the only thing that matters. And if it makes your life more difficult, if it means you have lost choices that you wouldn't have otherwise had, well, that's life. Because life is about restriction of choice on behalf of responsibility. And this happens to be the greatest responsibility any human being can have. It's what makes you a better person. Frankly, it makes your life worth living. Whatever else I do in my life will not be as important as me raising my children. It's the most important thing that I'm going to do in my life, and that's true for every human being who properly raises a child. As for the argument that if we don't abort certain babies, they will grow up in horrific circumstances, that's an argument for changing their circumstances, not for killing the kid. It's an absurd argument that a kid is going to be born into a bad household, therefore the baby should die. There are lots of kids who are in bad households right now. We don't get to kill them. Argument number four is that it makes life better for women to have an availability of abortion. The argument here is that women are unfairly burdened with pregnancy and childbearing. Well, maybe that's true, but you're going to have to talk to God on that one. Or evolution, or nature, or biology. Okay, that is not the fault of the patriarchy. As it turns out, contrary to common belief, men cannot be pregnant. Only women can be pregnant. Men do not have these responsibilities, though, this is the argument, and therefore they are free to fly like eagles and enjoy their lives and go to strip clubs and such. First off, this is a pretty dismissive view of the amazing gift that it is to be able to bear and rear a child. I mean, that's a superpower, ladies. To see this as something that you have done, that something bad that happened to you, being able to make another human in your body and then take that other human out of your body and feed that other human with your body, I mean, no man on earth has a power that is anything remotely akin to that. It's the most amazing thing. It really is. I mean, I've watched it in action a couple of times, and it is unfreaking believable. It's incredible. Also, contrary to popular second wave and third wave feminist opinion, most women seem relatively happy with this arrangement. Most women seem pretty excited when they get pregnant. Most women seem pretty happy when they have a child. This idea that women get pregnant and their first reaction is misery, as a general rule, is just a lie. And if women are taught that they should be miserable when they are pregnant, they should be miserable when they have children, then society is doing a garbage job. Also, this idea that all of your choices are restricted because now you can't have abortion, we have this thing called abstinence. I know it's fallen out of favor. I know it's fallen out of favor. But we do have this thing called abstinence. I know because I practiced it. I was abstinent until marriage. So was my wife. I am very happy about that. That was a good thing for me. It was a good thing for my wife. I don't feel that I was wildly deprived of all the good times. I feel like I live a pretty damn fulfilled life, and a life in which my wife knows that I'm committed to her, and she knows she's committed to me. One of the great irritants to me is this notion that has become so prevalent in modern culture that if you have a biological drive to do something, therefore there is no way for you to stop yourself from doing it. It's absolute nonsense. It's the first thing you teach children is how dumb this is. I mean, seriously, kids are little monsters. I love my children, but all they do is destroy things and yell at me and act. When people say that a two-year-old or a five-year-old is cute and brilliant and wonderful, they mean for a two or a five-year-old. They don't mean for like a normal human. Right? If a normal human who is 25 acted like a two or a five-year-old, they would be the worst person you have ever heard of. The reason I bring this up is because 2- and 5-year-olds don't have a fully developed prefrontal cortex. They are not capable of making decisions, which is why you as a parent make decisions for them. However, once you are an adult, it is time for you to start making responsible decisions and stop being a whiner. Stop being a baby. Stop acting like your biological urge justifies any action you wish to take. We also, I know, this is another newfangled thing. We have this thing called birth control. It's been around for a while. If you don't want to get pregnant, you can actually use that. You don't even have to abide by my moral strictures. You can just go out and do whatever you want, basically. And, you know, good luck to you. I don't think that's a good way to fulfill either body or soul, but we have a way for you not to be pregnant if you do not wish to be pregnant. So you don't get to say that abortion is restricting your choices when you can literally go down to the local pharmacy and make sure that you do not get pregnant for less than $5. The fifth argument that's often used with regard to abortion is the rape and incest argument. This argument is intellectually dishonest. The reason this argument is intellectually dishonest is because when somebody says, we need abortion availability because of rape and incest, if you say to them, okay, so you want all the other abortions banned? You're okay with banning all the other abortions? We're just arguing about rape and incest. They'll say, no. We need all the other abortions to be available so that we can have abortion in the case of rape and incest. Well, no. Then what you are doing is you are using the outlying case in order to get rid of the rule. That is bad logic. On every level, that is bad logic. That's using the exception to get rid of the rule. You can't do that. What you could say is, let's say that those were arguable cases, rape and incest. What you could say is, okay, well, let's take those off the table. Let's say that you can get an abortion in the case of rape and incest. I'll get to the actual case in a second. But you still want to keep the rest of them legal. Why? Why should the woman who just was irresponsible and got pregnant, and the baby's perfectly healthy and now she's 7 months pregnant, didn't do anything about it, why should she be able to get an abortion in order to make it available for a woman who was raped or the victim of incest? It's just an intellectually dishonest red herring, usually thrown out by people who have no intention of restricting abortion to the cases of rape and incest. So if they are willing to go along with me the other 99% of the way, then we can have a decent argument about rape and incest. But if you're just using that as a club so that we can't talk about the real issue, well, then that's a waste of time. Because statistically speaking, if you are saying that we have to allow the abortion of 1 million unborn children a year because of 1,900 women a year, maybe, who are victims of rape and incest and get pregnant from that rape or incest, that's going to be real low. The actual numbers, by the way, as of 1979, the Guttmacher Institute, which is a very pro-abortion institute, they say that there were a total of 3,675 women who had abortions paid for by federal money. The institute said it knew which category qualified only 2,444 of the women. Of those, 72 were eligible because of rape or incest. The number of women who undergo rape or incest every year is a very low number. It's not 1,900, it's slightly higher, but it is a very low number as compared with the entirety of all abortions. Okay, now, as to the morality of abortion in the cases of rape and incest, we have to make a logical disconnect and an emotional disconnect here. Rape and incest are acts of ultimate evil. Whoever perpetrates a rape or an incest should be castrated or killed. Right? That is evil. Now, what do you do with the baby is a different question. The baby is not responsible for the rape. The baby is not responsible for the incest. The baby is an independent human life, as we have mentioned. And this means that the baby is not responsible for the sins of the parent. So we can say that rape and incest are an ultimate evil while at the same time saying that the life of a child ought to be maintained. If you are a victim of a horrible crime, that does not mean that you get to perpetrate another crime against an innocent person. Argument number 6, it's my body. This is the most childish of all the arguments. It's my body, leave my body alone. No one cares about your body. No one cares. Honestly, get over yourselves. No one is interested. Okay, what we are interested in is the child that is inside your body. Honestly, it's the most bizarre argument. Oh, you want your hands on my body. I promise you, as a man, the part of a woman's body a man wants to be near least is the uterus. This is the dumbest possible argument. This notion that men, they just want their hands inside my uterus. I don't know what your sex life is like, but that's weird. But the kind of more formal version of the argument is that there's a sort of libertarian bodily autonomy argument, that if it were not for my body, this baby would not be able to survive, so wouldn't you be able to cut the cord? Well, first, there are two big moral problems with this argument. Number one, unless you're a victim of rape or incest, you do bear responsibility for the child that is now growing inside your body. If you have created a duty, well, then the entire relationship changes. So if you are responsible for the child growing inside your body, you now owe a duty to that child growing inside your body. When it comes to rape and incest, the argument is a little bit more complicated, because there, it's not your fault that the baby is growing inside your body. However, you are still related to that baby. And so that does make a difference as well. That does make a moral difference, right? That baby is half you, as well as being half this evil person who did this terrible thing to you. It is also true that it is not just as simple as snipping a cable or something. Okay, there is an act of violence. The problem, abortion is not passive. Abortion is not a matter of disconnecting a cord. You know, the case that people usually use is the famous violinist. Oh, you wake up in a room and there's a violinist, and the violinist is in a coma. They have to hook him up to you for 9 months. Can you disconnect the cord? From a libertarian perspective, sure. But you have to ask a different question. What if at the end of the 9 months, the violinist can get up and walk out and be totally fine? That changes the moral compass. What if that violinist happens to be your brother? That changes the moral compass too. What if it's your long-lost brother you didn't know existed, but you just found out it's your brother? That changes the moral compass. Your child, regardless of how it was attached to you, is indeed your child. Okay, argument number 7, safety for the mother. So this one is number one. When people say that pro-life people are in favor of mothers dying in order to bear babies, this is untrue. I can't name a single pro-life person that I know in the pro-life movement who suggests that it is incumbent upon a mother to die in order to birth the baby. Every pro-lifer that I know believes in a life exception for the mother. It is also true that medicine has now progressed to such a stage that this is almost never, and I mean almost never, an issue. The idea that you have to choose between the baby and the mom, you have to abort the baby to save the mom, this is so rare as to be negligible in terms of statistics. Not only that, when this is broadened out to life or health of the mother, then it becomes an excuse to have abortion on demand. So this argument isn't really an argument. Again, it's more of an emotional appeal. Argument number 8 is the argument of is the slippery slope argument, that if we don't allow women to kill the babies inside them, then it's just like The Handmaid's Tale. Let's put on our red costumes and our Pringles hat and walk around like nutsos. We've seen all these people who show up at Brett Kavanaugh's hearing dressed up in Handmaid's Tale outfits because abortion is going to be outlawed. I fail to see the relationship. I really do. I've read The Handmaid's Tale. It's okay. It's a mediocre book. It's fine. Okay, but the notion that we are linking, you're not allowed to kill the baby in your womb with, we want to chain you down and rape you to produce new babies, that's a real stretch. You're going to have to take a fair number of steps between here and there. And if we're talking about people who engage in surrogacy based on economic pressure, you're going to have to look to our leftist friends in Hollywood, where most of this happens to occur. Argument number 9 is the dumbest of all the arguments, I think, which is that there are too many people already. This is the environmental Malthusian Green New Deal argument. It's the variation of the Cory Booker, there are too many farting cows, so we should be vegan argument. Our world is better because of people. Our world is better because of babies. We have more human capital, more brilliance, more love, more awareness. More people is a good thing. And if you don't agree, then which few billion would you kill now? If you're that deeply worried about overpopulation, which ones do you want to get rid of? Like, not the ones who have yet to be born, like the ones who are around now. Which ones are the ones who aren't important that we can just kind of, you know, do away with? If you're that worried about we're robbing the commons and impoverishing the world. It's also true, by the way, that in the West, we need more people, not fewer people. Okay, we can't support our social safety net, frankly, if we don't have more babies. It's why you're seeing mass immigration from areas outside Europe and outside the United States. It's because countries that have strong social safety nets are aging rapidly. They haven't had enough kids, and now they're bringing in younger people from abroad in order to fill jobs and make sure that those social safety nets are paid for on a pure economic level. Beyond that, it is just a lie that human beings can't innovate their way to making room for more people. At the beginning of the 20th century, there were, what, 2 billion people on the planet? Now there are 8 billion people on the planet living better than they ever have in human history. Julian Simon, who is a professor at University of Maryland, he had a bet in the mid-80s with Paul Ehrlich, who was one of these Malthusian theorists. And Paul Ehrlich suggested, the bet was this. Paul Ehrlich could pick any 3 commodities, any 3. And he would say that over the next 10 years, these 3 commodities will get more expensive because of shortages. There'll be too many people, the price will go up, there'll be shortages. And Julian Simon said, pick any 3 commodities, the price will go down because of human ingenuity and our ability to innovate. So Paul Ehrlich picked three commodities, and the price went down on all 3. Human beings have a unique capacity to adapt to their environment, and they have a unique capacity to make room for more people. A final argument is one of the more evil arguments, actually, which is that abortion lowers the crime rate. This is the one where I got myself in trouble at the March for Life. And the reason I got myself in trouble at the March for Life is because I said something true about abortion, which you're not allowed to say. So there's an argument in Freakonomics that the reason there was a dip in crime rates in the mid-90s is because a lot of babies were killed right after Roe v. Wade. Now, this is what we would call a racist argument, because the majority of people, or the plurality of people who were being killed after Roe v. Wade, of the unborn, were poor and minority. So I guess the argument is that if you kill a lot of unborn poor minority children, you are lowering the crime rate. That sounds incredibly racist to me. It seems to me that a baby that is unborn is not responsible for actions they have not yet taken and will never have the potential to take. And trying to label them a potential criminal by dint of their race or upbringing is an act of racism. It is an act of bigotry. To illustrate this concept, I was saying that no baby should ever be blamed for crimes they have not yet committed. That is an act of evil. In fact, it's an act of eugenic evil. It is itself Hitlerian. Okay, this is what Hitler said about the Jews. The Jews will inevitably ruin our society, therefore let's kill them now. Let's nip them in the bud. If you're saying that about babies that are unborn, saying you're going to lower the crime rates by killing a certain cadre of babies, that is an act of evil. And then I used a famous example, which was originally, I believe, told by the New York Times in 2015. Tom Hanks talked about it, the case of baby Hitler. Would you go back and kill baby Hitler? And the case that I made is that baby Hitler was not yet Hitler. Baby Hitler was a baby. And thus, if you are a pro-life decent person, the answer would not be to kill a baby who may have a shot at becoming a criminal. It would be to work to keep that baby alive and put them in circumstances where they will not go on to commit evil crimes, because we have free will and an environment in which we can control how well people act. For the record, it's also not statistically true that abortion caused the drop in crime rates. The drop in crime rates was a result of increased incarceration. I know it's unpopular these days. It was a result of increased policing, increased incarceration that kicked in the early to mid-90s. The crime rates began to drop in 1995. Roe v. Wade was put in place in 1973. The cohort of people who would have had to be killed were too old by then to have matched up with the cohort that was not there to commit the crimes. Here's the bottom line. Abortion is a grave evil. The reason it's a grave evil is because we believe, on the basis of both logic and religious principle, on the basis of natural law, that human beings have inherent value, that you were made in the image of God. And if you believe that human beings are special, then you have to believe that your specialness began the moment you were conceived. Because where else would it begin? That is the point of biological contact. It is necessary to preserve that feeling of the innate value of human life if we are to be a better country and a better people. Thanks so much. Happy to take your questions. Thank you. All righty. Now for the fun part. So, questions. They don't have to be about abortion.
Hey, guys. We're going to start the Q&A. If you will do me a favor and go to the outsides, don't come to the front, or you're going to be sent to the back of the line. One question per person. No follow-ups. I'm going to hold the mic. Please don't try to grab it, okay? If you'll just stand right behind Josh, and we'll let the first person up whenever we get ready.
Hey, my question is on the legality of abortions, specifically how abortion can be legal, and at the same time, if someone was to murder a pregnant woman, they would go to trial for double homicide. And how do those not contradict each other?
They do contradict each other, which is why the state of New York just made it so that if you kill a baby in the process of assaulting your girlfriend, that's not a separate crime. Really, the only crime is the assault on the girlfriend, not the killing of the baby in the womb, which shows the unbelievable immorality of this, right? So if you walked up to a nine-month pregnant woman and you just punched her in the stomach until she miscarried, this would not be considered a crime other than the assault on the woman. It would be considered the same as if you punched her in the arm when she wasn't pregnant. Everybody knows how stupid and evil this is. And of course, you're exactly right. This is why Lacey's Law in California, as it was called, made it a separate crime to harm an unborn human being. All righty.
Is it me? Yeah. So, the first state to legalize abortion in case of rape or incest was Colorado in 1967. Hawaii followed in 1970. We can reasonably assume that there were abortions before then. So if we went back to a world where abortion was illegal, how would we deal with the black market? What do you think positive or negative consequences would be of an increased amount of illegal abortions? And would we prosecute both the mother and the doctor, or just one? How would we handle it?
So first of all, I see that you're a Democrat, and so I appreciate you coming tonight. Really, it's good of you to come and have a discussion. Now,
You're a very eloquent speaker.
Well, that's very nice of you. So the answer to the question is that there's no major pro-life voice in America who advocates for prosecuting the mother. The reason that people don't advocate for prosecuting the mother is, number one, because it is counterproductive, because your goal is to convince women that they shouldn't abort their babies, not to threaten them with punishment. You want them to make the moral choice. Basically, honey is going to win people over more than vinegar. But beyond that, I think that there is a real problem of mens rea, meaning that when you're talking about intent to commit a crime, you actually have to have an intent to commit the crime. So if I'm going to commit homicide upon you, then I have to know that you are a human being, for example. I think that a lot of women have been made to believe, for wrong reasons, that what they are killing is not actually a human being, and so they lack the requisite mens rea for a homicide charge, even if you were to try and game it out legally. Mostly what people on the pro-life side have talked about is prosecuting abortion doctors who make an actual business out of aborting babies. As to the increase in illegal abortions, I would assume there would be an increase in illegal abortions because all abortions would be illegal. And just logically speaking, anytime you make something illegal that occurs, there will be more illegal instances of that thing happening. And I'm sure that, you know, when slavery was legal, then, you know, it was legal. That didn't make it either moral, decent, or right. Once it was made illegal, then I'm sure that everyone who was holding a slave was in violation of the law. You know, so I guess there were more illegal holdings of slaves after we made slavery illegal. But there was less absolute slavery, which is the actual goal. Yeah, you can ask a follow-up. That's fine.
Illegally holding a slave doesn't kill the slave and doesn't possibly kill the mother.
I don't think you want to go down the road where you're justifying slavery.
Slavery. I'm saying that the fact that something increases when you make it illegal is
the illegal activity is the absolute level of the activity decreases, but what's left is going to be illegal just by logical necessity.
When the illegal activity that's left is very, very dangerous, is that a good argument? Do you think that's a good argument or not a good argument?
Yes. Let's say that you make abortion illegal and there are a million abortions a year in the United States, and let's say at the high end, there are still 50,000 illegal abortions in the United States, but all the rest go to term. Okay, let's say that that's the case, because it's going to be hard to actually get an abortion if it's made illegal. Let's say there's still 50,000. You just saved 950,000 lives. That is a massive net win, obviously. I think it would go down extraordinarily heavily because, again, I think you'd be prosecuting the doctors. This is why you don't prosecute the mothers. Prosecuting the doctors, it's hard to make a living as a doctor while you're doing that. You actually require somebody who's relatively expert to perform an abortion.
I have a question about a little bit of a paradox. I have family that escaped the former Soviet Union, so it's about the paradox of unlimited tolerance. Any society that is unlimitedly tolerant will eventually tolerate something that destroys it. So if we tolerate people whose position is the violation of our natural rights and essentially our liquidation, we're ensuring that it'll end. So how do we avoid that?
So I think that there's activity that is obviously intolerable. For example, violent activity, incitement to overthrow the lawful government of the United States, right? All of that's illegal in the United States, and no regime can withstand it. With that said, you know, in a republic, the feeling is that convincing is going to be of more value than compelling. And that's why I spend my life doing what I'm doing, and that's why it's incumbent on all of us as good citizens to be educated in this and go out and proselytize on behalf of the viewpoint. Is it a riskier thing for a regime to tolerate dissent? Of course it's riskier to the regime to tolerate dissent. But if the inherent value you're trying to protect is the value of free speech itself, then you have no choice but to tolerate dissent. It's what makes so in certain ways it's more dangerous, in certain ways it's a lot safer. Let's put it this way. I would much rather not trust the government to pick and choose which opinions are okay than allow the government to shut down opinions that I don't like.
Hey,
you doing, Ben? Quick two-parter for you. One, I just want to get your take on what do you think the United States should be doing about monetary policy and the Federal Reserve. I personally believe the Fed should be audited and also ended. We're not getting a lot of information right now from the GAO and everything like that. And then the second part of that question is, one of the most evil leaders in history, in my personal opinion, is Roger Goodell, and why does he continue to marginalize the Patriots? And also Dave Portnoy of Barstool Sports. Just wanted to get your take on that.
So I'm going to beg off the Roger Goodell question. I got nothing on that. As far as the Fed, I'm fine with auditing the Fed. I happen to be a fan of Viennese economics, as in F.A. Hayek, Viennese economics. So I'm a fan of the idea of going back to a standard for the dollar where it is pegged to the value of gold, and where it is not the job of the federal government to inflate or deflate the currency, where it is not the job of the federal government to set interest rates. I don't like the idea of a centralized bank that can be controlled by any political force trying to determine which direction the economy is going to go. Because it turns out that the Fed creates bubbles, and then the Fed bursts bubbles. It turns out that the Fed can put the damper on the economy in ways that it shouldn't be able to. And it also encourages a real moral hazard in the sense that we all rely on the Fed to keep our money safe, and sometimes our money isn't safe. And that, in turn, requires more government interventionism to maintain the illusion that our money is always safe.
I can't hold the mic, but I'll talk to this hand, I suppose. Hi, Ben. So let me preface this a little bit, and bear with me here, because this might take a minute or so for me to fully outline. But so ever since I've made initial contact with the ideas stemming from the radical left, I've initially had a disliking to them, but they're distasteful. I don't really like them. And I've been obsessed with these ideas for north of 5 years now. And I've been listening to you and other people like you, you know, people like Jordan Peterson, right? People on that sort of aisle of things, more or less, pro-free speech, and I'm for that, and I understand that. But I sort of changed my aim, and I'm coming from a place of bridge building, more or less, and I want peace, and I want prosperity, and I think it can be achieved. But something that I realized, and this took a great degree of empathy on my part, because I'm coming from this side of things, that... And this is hard for me to say because they're novel ideas to me, but what I'm trying to say is that we, as in you, as in everyone here in this room, we are responsible for the growth and for the continuance of the growth of the radical left. And the only way the radical left is truly going to shrink from its somewhat monstrous size and its growing size is if we, and I'm gonna generalize here, as men who initiate things, take responsibility for the current situation of things, and we must understand and empathize from their framework. Their arguments, they're not that well built. They're not logically coherent. But we must see
I'm with you, but we need to get to the question mark.
Right. There's really no question mark, and it's more of a statement, and I kind of just want to see what you think and more.
I mean, listen, I think that the only way for there to be any common agreement is for there to actually be agreement. So I'm not going to create a false agreement where there is none. I'm in favor of clarification in many cases. You're right that the great dearth that we have in the country right now is of people who have decided to shirk responsibility. And that's true on all sides of the aisle. I see it from populists on the right, and I see it from socialists on the left. I see it from people who believe that the government should take care of them on the right because, you know, they're a protected class, and I see it the same thing on the left. The only way the country is going to get better is if we re-embrace certain central values of the West that have always been true. The idea of innate human freedom to act, the idea that a limited government provides you with the innate freedom to act, the idea that there is a discoverable purpose in the universe toward which you can direct your reason, right? All of these things are deeply important. If we re-embrace those, then I think we can save the West. If not, then I think that we're bound to either atomize and separate into individuals who don't talk to one another, or we are bound to fall back into a sort of Tower of Babel belief that we can all build something greater together, which looks a lot more like fascism or communism. Thanks. Sorry.
Okay. First of all, could you sign my?
yeah, if you got a pen. You have a pen on you? Okay. That'll retail for at least $9 on eBay.
Okay, I can't pull it up. But recently, someone at my school compared Andrew Jackson to Trump in that he fired people who didn't agree with him or didn't do what he wanted them to do. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, frankly, Andrew Jackson was fond of shooting people who didn't agree with him. So that was, so not quite the same, although Trump may yet shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, and we'll see if he loses support. I think it's a strained comparison. I think that the only sort of comparison that makes sense along those lines is that Jackson was considered sort of an ignoramus at the time running against John Quincy Adams, and Trump is considered somewhat of the same. Jackson is considered a populist in the sense that he was connected with the people, and Trump repeats some of those same mantras. But the notion that there's some sort of great history of Jacksonian thought in Trump, I mean, I think that that sentence doesn't make sense because it contains the words Trump and thought. So, you know, Trump is a lot of things. He's a doer, he builds some stuff, he says a lot of things. He's not really a thinker. So the idea that he was sitting around reading biographies of Andrew Jackson, he's like, ah, now I have some ideas about the National Bank. I have some deep-seated issues. I know Steve Bannon well, okay? And this was Steve Bannon's shtick, was that Donald Trump was just another Andrew Jackson type. Yeah, okay. There's a reason that Steve is basically a homeless person now.
Hi.
What a beautiful cluster of cells.
Thank you, 7 weeks old.
It's amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question. I'm pro-vaccination. However, as a preschool teacher, I run into a lot of parents who aren't. So my question is, do you believe that people should be compelled by law to vaccinate themselves or their children?
So this is one of my more controversial positions. My answer is yes. The reason that my answer is yes is because the vaccination science is extraordinarily clear. Here is where I say my wife is a doctor. It is also true that all of the supposed links between, for example, vaccinations and autism are complete sheer nonsense. The person who originally put out those claims was forced to retract all of those claims. It just happens that autism happens to manifest about the same age that the children are very often getting vaccinations, but correlation does not equal causation. The fact that we now see measles, which is a highly dangerous and highly contagious disease, being spread around schools is extraordinarily dangerous. There are certain, and when people argue about whether vaccinations should be compelled, after all, does it hurt anybody else? This is a question of externality. So as a conservative, I don't believe people should be compelled to do anything unless it causes externality to others. However, failing to vaccinate your kid does have externalities because herd immunity is necessary in order to protect people who can't actually protect themselves, kids who have cancer and can't get vaccinations, pregnant women who can't have vaccinations. So this is a really serious issue. With that said, should we always be looking to develop better forms of vaccines that, for example, have less of a rate of developing into Guillain-Barré syndrome, which can sometimes occur thanks to particular vaccine lines? Of course, we should always do better. But the rates of this are exorbitantly low, I mean extraordinarily low. And there's a reason that so many diseases that plagued humanity for legitimately tens of thousands of years legitimately disappeared from planet Earth as of about 50 or 60 years ago, once people realized what germ theory was and that vaccinations were actually effective. So I know there are a lot of folks who are upset with me, actually, about my vaccination position on this, but I do have a very strong vaccination position. And again, if it causes an externality not to vaccinate your kids, then it's a problem for you not to vaccinate your kids.
Got another question about abortion for you. What is your opinion on emergency contraceptives? Should they be allowed in any situation? Should they only be allowed in certain situations, such as, for example, taking it the day after the day of rape or incest, for example?
So I will beg off in terms of the biological knowledge in terms of emergency contraception in certain cases. What I will say is that on a principled basis, if what you are preventing is fertilization, I don't have a problem with it. If what you are preventing is implantation, I do have a problem with it. Right? This is the difference between sort of the Newt Gingrich position on abortion and mine. So Newt Gingrich suggests that life begins at implantation. That makes no biological sense to me. The minute that the conception occurs, you now have an individual life that has been formed. And implantation, for people who believe that men can become women and women can be men, become men and therefore don't believe in science or don't know science, Implantation is when the actual fertilized egg lands in the side of the uterus and begins to basically nest there, which is where it will be for the next several months. So if plan B, for example, my understanding is that sometimes it prevents fertilization, sometimes it prevents implantation. If I don't know, I'm against it. If it's only preventing fertilization, I have no problem with it. If it prevents implantation, I do have a problem with it.
Hi, if more libertarian economic policy is preferable to you, why did the economy do quite well historically with left-leaning economic policies in place, more specifically in time period from the New Deal to Nixon?
So the economy did extraordinarily poorly from the time of the New Deal all the way up until World War II. UCLA economists suggest that the Great Depression was lengthened by a minimum of 8 years by the economic policies that were purveyed by FDR and his arbitrary and foolish economic policy, which really predated him. Hoover was instituting the same exact policies right after the crash of 1929. So those policies really extended from like 1929 all the way to the outbreak of World War I. The economic growth that took place the economic growth that took place in the aftermath of World War II was a result of several factors. One was actual deregulation of the economy. Remember, there was rationing during World War II. Also, the entire world was destroyed except for the United States. When you are the only mass producer still available on planet Earth and every other Western country has been decimated, that provides a pretty good export market, as it turns out. And so there wasn't a lot of competition in the marketplace. As other countries developed, then they were able to compete better in terms of manufacturing, which is why you see the car industry in the United States slowing down in the 1970s and 1980s. As far as the idea that economic growth is tied to heavy government interventionism, that obviously is untrue to the extent that the heavier the government intervention, the less economic growth there is. I don't have to cite Venezuela or Cuba. So the question is, even if you believe that government interventionism is good for the economy, which I don't, then where do you think the happy medium lies? Is it the policies of FDR and LBJ? Or is it possible that the policies of the early 1920s, which were economic boom times for the United States and were extraordinarily libertarian, are better economic policies? There's a reason that entrepreneurs, business owners seek out places where they are taxed less and regulated less. There's a reason that the United States is still the world's most powerful economy, and it's because of all the developed countries, we are the least regulated and in many cases the least taxed, although not on a corporate level. So government interventionism, the record that government interventionism has caused economic strength in the United States is scanty at best. I mean, that correlation does not even match up, in my opinion.
Hi, Ben. Big fan. I was wondering, first of all, if I could get a picture.
Sure. Yeah, you're going to have to selfie it.
Turn around. All right, here we go.
You can let that haunt your dreams for the next few years.
Thank you. My question was about your opinion on Disneyland. Specifically, what are your favorite food, drinks, and rides, current and defunct?
That's what I haven't heard before. So Disneyland is a wonderful place. And in fact, in my family, like meaning me and my sisters, we actually had a rule. If you take a date to Disneyland and they can't enjoy Disneyland, don't marry this person. This person is a cynic and cannot have fun in life. Disneyland is a wonderful place. The food, I have to say, I'm limited in my choices. I keep kosher, so I bring food to the park with me when we go. I will admit that my wife and I and our children have an annual pass to Disneyland, so we go a lot. It actually is one of the beautiful things about Disneyland is that your experience of the park changes as your kids grow older. So when they're really little, you're going mainly to Fantasyland, and like my daughter likes to see the princesses and stuff. And then as they get older, you'll end up in Tomorrowland and be doing Space Mountain and stuff like that. When I was growing up, my favorite ride was Thunder Mountain. That was the place to be, was Thunder Mountain. So as you can see, I'm a thrill a minute.
Hey, Ben. I've been waiting for a long time. I've kind
so
of
have
pondered
I for this moment.
Yeah. I've kind of pondered how to ask this, but how does your view of transgender issues work when scientific anti-realism as a concept exists?
You're going to have to explain that one.
All right. So scientific anti-realism is the concept that when you see me, you see, you know, my skin, my hands, everything about me, but you do not see my cells. You do not see my atoms. You do not see the things that make up the things. They are just physical. So there is no really true way to prove, other than by hitting me, obviously, that I am right here, if it is only us two talking. So therefore, this would apply to any gendering things, including intersex, which can have an XX or XY chromosome and have androgen or estrogen insensitivity. So
I just need you to narrow this down. Is the argument that we don't understand the nature of things because we don't have microscopes, and therefore we can't determine sex?
I would like to narrow it down to, we cannot fully identify a gender of a person right when we see them, so therefore I believe that it is not within my own individual liberty to gender that person.
Okay, so here's my problem with that particular argument. The answer is that in 99.8%, 99.9% of cases, you absolutely can gender somebody based on looking at them. Like, really. If you're going to use intersex people as an example of not being able to do that, this does not obviate the biological duality of sex upon which all progeneration is based for all of human history and for all mammalian species. So intersex people do not invalidate the concept of sex as a generality. Intersex people are people who have a biological anomaly. And by the way, in most cases of intersex, those people still manifest as either a male or a female. So the idea that intersex exists does not invalidate the idea that there is a male and that there is a female, or that in nearly all cases, I can tell the difference between a male and a female. Again, I'm not saying, by the way, that if you can show me your chromosomal charts that you are actually not a male, when I say that you're a male, that I should stick with that biological objective standard. Like, my perception of you, in other words, is subject to my correct enunciation of an objective standard. So the objective standard, here's the deal. For all of human history, there was an objective standard between male and female. It was, for nearly all of human history, out of partial ignorance and partially because this is usually true, it was out of simply looking at people's genitals and assessing them based on their outward appearance, right? Which is still true for nearly all human beings on planet Earth at all times. Okay. What was that?
You can't really describe someone without secondary sex characteristics and gender them into something.
Well, I mean, you can based on primary sex characteristics if you can see their genitals. Yes. Doctors do this literally at birth all the time. Yes. Right? So your point is correct. If somebody was male dressed as a female and I misgendered them and then they said, "Oh, look, I'm male." Zip. Right? Then I would say correct. And then correct. I would say for all of human history you were male. Now the standard is chromosomal. Right? It's the SRNY gene and all of this. There is some objective standard, in other words, by which we can determine sex. The problem I have with the transgender argument is that people are arguing that there is no objective standard, that no objective standard exists by which I can determine sex. And in fact, sex is completely subjective. I can determine my own gender based on no biology and, in fact, in abeyance of biology. I can have every single biological characteristic of a male, and if I say I am female, then I am female. This is anti-scientific nonsense. Yes, Caitlyn Jenner had every biological characteristic of a male. There is no evidence whatsoever that Caitlyn Jenner was a female, because Caitlyn Jenner was an Olympic athlete as a male with all of the chromosomes and all of the junk and all of it, right? That is it. That is a biological male. And then we are supposed to believe that Caitlyn Jenner is a female. Listen, I'm happy to call Caitlyn Jenner Caitlyn, because people can legally change their name. If I were out to dinner with Caitlyn Jenner, I wouldn't go out of my way to say Caitlyn Jenner is a he, because why would I want to have a bad dinner with somebody? But if I'm speaking in public with folks and I'm talking about the presence of sex, there is not a biologist worth their salt on planet Earth who would say that sex does not exist.
Yeah, I agree.
So if sex exists, then what are the characteristics of sex? And the problem with biological anti-realism or scientific anti-realism, as you're suggesting, is that there is no actual standard of sex, that it's completely malleable. It's okay. Do you have a quick response? I don't want to cut you off.
I'm not saying that sex is malleable. I'm saying there is male and female biologically. That is true, yes.
Right.
But I'm saying that gender is a spectrum. I'm saying that there is at least male, female, and non-binary because of this strange...
And what I'm saying is that there's a word game that goes on when people discuss gender. Because if we are talking about certain characteristics to which we attribute to masculine or feminine, if you want to say that there's a genetic male with feminine characteristics, we're fine. That's a male with feminine characteristics. Fine. That's fine. I mean, okay. So, you're a man with feminine characteristics. That's cool. Who cares? Okay, but that doesn't make you a woman. In other words, what we are now doing is we're playing a semantic game where we say a male with feminine characteristics is a woman. That's nonsense. Or a woman with male characteristics, masculine characteristics, is a man. That's nonsense too. And by the way, it actually ends up misgendering a lot of people who are just butch women or effeminate men.
Yeah, I agree.
Right? So all of this, so in other words, by trying to separate out gender and sex completely, and then by using terms like male and female or woman and man that are innately connected to sex, what you are doing is deliberately, not you, what people are doing is deliberately confusing the issue such that you get idiocies like Ilhan Omar writing to the Powerlifting Association of the USA saying that a transgender woman who is a biological male should be able to compete against biological women because it is a myth that men can pick up heavier objects than women. That is not a myth. That's called science. Thank you.
Hi, Ben. Do you mind if I get a quick autograph?
Okay, come on up. Let's do it.
So I'm from Southern California as well, and growing up in Southern California, I learned how to get along with people on the other side of the aisle. But I know that there are also a lot of people who are unable to get along with other people as soon as politics comes up. So my question to you is, how can I, as a friend or just a first-time stranger, kind of facilitate and help people be okay with connecting bridges?
I mean, honestly, I think it's a temperament thing. What I mean by this is that you can usually tell within the first 30 seconds of a conversation which way this thing is going. Sometimes people want to have an honest conversation and they want to talk about issues from a disagreeing point of view. I have a lot of friends who disagree with me politically. The entire intellectual dark web, I believe I'm the only registered Republican in the intellectual dark web, so I'm constantly talking with people who disagree with me. I love doing it. That's a different thing than debating somebody on a stage, right? Debating somebody on a stage, you're performing in front of an audience to a certain extent, and it depends. Are you there to have a conversation or are you there to destroy somebody? So you sort of have to determine before the conversation begins where it's going to go. But there are a lot of situations, honestly, the first clue is if somebody attacks your character. If somebody attacks your character for having a dissenting point of view, then this is a conversation that is not only going nowhere, but it's counterproductive and you should leave as soon as possible. Because you can't have any good conversation with anyone who's attacking your character. You can't do it with a spouse. Right? Well, the first thing that you learn when you're married is that the thing you should never say to your spouse is, you always do X. Because that's an attack on character. And it is, and it's not true usually. Right? Instead, if you're going to have a productive conversation, it's you just did this thing, and I'm upset you just did this thing. The attack on character ends a conversation. Doesn't matter what the conversation is. That's particularly true in politics.
Hey, Ben. So I wanted to ask you a question. You said earlier that a lot of Democrats are uncomfortable looking at pictures of children that are being aborted. Yeah, I would say that you and many other Republicans would feel equally uncomfortable looking at pictures of Sandy Hook victims who were shot. How can you honestly stand up here and say that you support abortion, you support government intervention, excuse me, you support government intervention to make abortion illegal, which is designed to kill someone, and yet you can stand up here and say you don't want government intervention for guns, which are also designed to kill people?
Because guns are not designed to kill children. Guns are designed to kill bad guys if operated by a proper person. There's not an abortion in the world that doesn't end with the death of a baby. So I have no problem with looking at the pictures of gun violence victims other than the problems any other human being, left or right, would have with looking at those pictures, which is that they're horrific and deeply disturbing and very upsetting. But I don't feel any sense of guilt or avoidance. Like, I can't look at this picture because I bear some sort of responsibility for this. It is impossible not to look at a picture of an aborted baby and say this was disconnected from the act that I approve, because the act is the killing of the baby. There's no policy that I approve of that ends with the murder of children. Okay, there is a policy that is designed for the murder of children, which is what abortion is. Yeah, that's fine. You can have a quick follow-up. That's fine, sir.
Okay, so but if all people, right, you said that once the cells come together, you said those are considered people, which I can understand. I can get
behind
that.
No, I said that's considered a human life.
A human life, right.
Yes.
Why is this human life being killed and another human life being killed by gun violence? Why is that any different?
Again, it's not a matter of the value of the human life being different. It's equally as evil and tragic and horrific and disgusting when people kill fully formed children who are outside the womb. My point is that the act that connects to the killing of the children is not connected to my position on guns. The act that connects to the killing of unborn babies is connected to the legalization of abortion. The reason that I want people to be able to exercise their Second Amendment rights is to shoot pieces of like the people who go into schools and shoot up children. Right? Both my I have two kids. They both go to a Jewish school, which means they are on the target list for somebody out there. Right? Jewish schools are disproportionately targeted, unfortunately, in the United States. I went to a Jewish school when I was in high school. There were bomb threats legitimately every couple of months. In 1999, there was a white supremacist who drove by our Jewish day school, saw an armed guard outside, proceeded to drive away, went to the West Valley JCC, and shot up the West Valley JCC. The reason that I'm in favor of gun rights is because I want that armed guard outside carrying the gun to dissuade people from going inside the school and shooting the kid. I'm not in favor of...
Hi. You often cite this study from the Brookings Institute that says there's three simple things adolescents need to do to improve their economic standing who are living in poverty. Since it's so easy to follow these rules, do you view poverty as a fault in character?
No, I don't view poverty as a fault in character. I feel that sometimes poverty is a result of mistakes that are made that are faults in character, meaning that poverty itself is not the fault. I mean, a lot of us will go through poverty at some point in our life. Maybe we have a medical problem. You know, maybe we lose a job. So I'm not saying that poverty itself is the descriptor of a fault. What I am saying is that if you make mistakes that are obvious to avoid and then you end up poor, that's kind of your fault, right? So, but you have to make mistakes. You can't just say, oh, poor person, it's his fault that he's poor. What you can say is, oh, look, person who decided to drop out of high school, get pregnant out of wedlock, and never get a job, that person's poor. Yeah, kind of their fault. Right, because of the three decisions that they made. And the three decisions, for folks who don't know, are those three decisions, right? Finish high school, don't have a baby out of wedlock, and get a job, any job, right? If you fulfill all those three things, only 2% of people in the United States who do all three of those things end up in permanent poverty. So is poverty connected to your activity? Of course, poverty is very often connected with your activity, but the poverty is not what makes you a bad person, I can't inherently say the poor person did something wrong. I can't say the person who did something wrong did something wrong.
This will be our last question.
No pressure. I don't know if I'll have time for my question, but I have an answer to a question that you commonly pose whenever the topic of institutional racism is brought up.
Sure.
You always ask, where is the institution? Show me the racist laws so that we can fight them together.
Correct.
Welcome to Alabama. This would qualify as a racist institution, the state of Alabama.
So now I go back to the question that you say that you answered, which is, show me the law. You've named an institution you don't like, now show me the law.
No, it's not an institution I don't like. I've lived here my whole life. But
you called it racist, so I assume you're not super fond of it.
Yeah, it has flaws, to say the least. But the Constitution of Alabama demands that schools be segregated by race. If it weren't for the federal government, there would only be white people in this room. And we have tried to repeal this this language, to get it out of the Constitution, at least once a decade, and it has failed. Every time we have voted to keep segregation as law in the state of Alabama. So I'd say that qualifies the state as...
Yes, I will admit to you. Okay, so a couple of fundamental assumptions, okay? I'm going to admit I have not read the Constitution of the state of Alabama, so I don't know the provision that you are talking about. I will assume that it says what you say it says for the purposes of this conversation. If, in fact, there's a provision in the state law of Alabama that says that segregation is mandated by law, of course that's racist, that's Jim Crow, and that would be institutional racism. The point that I'm making is that there are a lot of black people in this room today because the institutional racism that you are decrying was, in fact, wiped out at the legal level by the federal government in the 1960s. So if you're citing a law from 1873 or 1865, whenever the Constitution embedded segregation, if you're citing that law to prove institutional racism and that law has not been applied for 50 years, you're going to need to do better.
There were several lawmakers in the last few years caught on tape talking about the need to suppress the black vote, referring to black people as aborigines and illiterates.
Right. I've always said there are racist people. And by the way, when there are people who act in maliciously racist fashion, in my opinion, I have donated money to their primary opponents. Right. I did that like a month ago for Steve King.
These are lawmakers, though. These are people who are actually making laws in this state.
So I don't understand where we disagree. In other words, if you show me the comment and I say I oppose the comment and therefore I oppose the lawmaker, and then they pass a law and I agree that the law is racist and I oppose the law, we don't disagree. So the point that I'm making is, are there people who are racist in the United States? Sure. Are there people who are racist in the government? I'm sure, because the government is representative of the United States. But when people talk about institutional racism, they tend to do so by suggesting, and this is my main argument about institutional racism, to put this in kind of rounded context. The main argument that I'm making about institutional racism is not that racism doesn't exist, it's that to attribute every disparity to discrimination, which is what seems to be the intersectional argument, that if one group of people has less property than another group of people, or one group of people has less wealth, or one group of people is less economically successful, or one group of people is less educated, that is the result of current, present-day institutional racism, that is not useful, and in fact, it's counterproductive. Because what it is doing is it is suggesting a fault that does not occur in the present. Now, I've also said in every speech that I've made for multiple years at this point that to deny historic racism would, of course, be idiocy. Of course, historic racism exists. Of course, that has present-day consequences. But that does not answer the question as to which policy currently in place is causing the disparity. So if you can point to the policy that is intended and designed to create disparity between groups, and then you can say that that is what causes the disparity between groups, then we can agree on abolishing the law. I want to get rid of those obstructions the same way that you do. My goal is that the law equally applies to everyone, meaning that everybody has the same rights. We're not all born with the same opportunity, because no one is. Some of us are born rich, some of us are born poor, some of us are born short like me, some people are born tall. Right? I mean, people are just born differently. Some people are born smarter and some people are born stupid. This is why Democrats exist. But the fact, it's just a joke. There are lots of smart Democrats. I just don't know why they do what they do. But with that said, I think what people make the mistake of doing is suggesting that because people end up in an unequal position every day, that is the result of current day people standing in their way and obstructing legal anti-discrimination. I don't think that's correct. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Wonderful to be here. Roll Tide.